This is to you. Thank you for managing to get here through all the bustle and busyness of Cambridge. And this is the second in a series of four I'm doing on William Blake this month. And the whole series is called William Blake, Ahead of His Time, Ahead of Ours, question mark. And I was trying to look very much at Blake as somebody who spoke well beyond his own time into ours. And some of his writing perhaps we'll only come to understand further as the 21st century continues. Last week I gave you an overview, a general feel for Blake. I gave you a handout with a wide variety of quotations from all over the place, and I talked a little bit about Blake in his own time and context. And I will be talking more about the world he grew up in, particularly the London. He was a Londoner born and bred. Apart from a brief time in Feltham, he lived his life in London. He was born in Broad Street, and he died in Fountain Court in the city. His vision is very much centred in some ways on London and the city. But I wanted this time to focus on a particular work. I wanted to start with the most famous and probably the most accessible of his works, The Songs of Innocence and Experience. Deceptively simple, particularly The Songs of Innocence, which was published first. You'll see on the handout, I put The Songs of Innocence, 1789, and Experience, 1794, although he may well have started to write The Songs of Experience pretty much as soon as he'd done The Songs of Innocence. He never published The Songs of Experience as a separate book. He always, once he'd written them, he combined it with The Innocence. And they really are, if I say that they're two halves of the same coin, all advancement, said Blake, is by contraries. Without contraries, there's no progress. And he worked with paradox. He worked with apparent contradictions and bringing them together. He worked with the sense of how our souls are, as it were, always in some sense, and our experience is always in some sense double-sided. But if I were to say that they were two sides of the same coin, I would be much nearer, in the case of Blake, to being literal rather than metaphorical when I use that cliche, that well-worn metaphor. A coin, of course, is a piece of metal engraved on both sides, but there are in existence, you know, objects one could covet and wish to have. The original copper plates on which Blake did this extraordinary technique, which he himself invented, called relief etching, which enabled him to make the extraordinary and beautiful objects, art objects, these books were. Copper, of course, was very valuable, and you would use both sides of the plate. But what Blake did, and I'd like to read you the account of this, which is written rather beautifully by his biographer, Peter Ackroyd. What Blake did was quite literally to inscribe the parallel or connecting connecting poem, when he had these poems in pairs, on the other side of the plate. So the tiger is literally inscribed on the reverse side of the lamb, and the two Chimney Sweep poems, which we'll look at, and the two Holy Thursday poems. Some of the Songs of Experience are unique and on their own, but many of them are, as it were, a converse too. And there's kind of all kinds of strange mirroring and reflecting in the very technique that he used. I'll perhaps just describe it rather than reading it from here. The technique involved, you know, reversing. So everything you'll see in some of these illustrations, the way these are plates from the Songs of Innocence and Experience in the original size. It's a tiny little book. You'll see the drawing and the picture and the words are all engraved out in writing. In order to do the writing, he actually had to write everything in reverse. So he used a mirror. And that's why, curiously, the writing is sloping the other way, but you can read. So there's an extraordinary series of awarenesses of mirroring, of opposites, of a whole made out of two severed halves, of, to borrow perhaps the most famous phrase from the entire collection, of fearful symmetry is involved. So I just wanted you to be aware of that, even in the very kind of production of these things. So he was able to print them out, and then he and his wife Catherine hand-coloured them. And of the 25 copies, for example, of the Songs of Innocence that exist, several of them have the poems in slightly different orders. Sometimes the colouring is subtly different and almost bringing out different elements in the poetry. And although we're going to have to work largely with the words, if you go on the web and do Songs of Innocence and Experience and images, you'll quite soon find sites whereby you can, as it were, use the web itself to turn the pages and see the images and read them as they were. You can do that. And there are books available. I waved this one last time. This is one that's very precious to me, although it's falling to bits. My mother gave me this, actually, just as I came up to Cambridge. And it's a reproduction. Obviously, they printed it out because it's easier to read. But this is the original book as you would have had it. Very beautifully coloured. Blake loved the Gothic in art. As a boy, when he was trained as an engraver, there were issues with some of the other apprentices who didn't get Blake and teased him, you know, because he was almost, as it were, a being for another plane. And Bazir, his apprentice master, he was apprentice for 7 years, sort of thought just to keep the peace, but also because he could see where Blake was coming from, sent him in his teenage years every day into Westminster Abbey to make drawings of the statues and monuments and the tracery and the beautiful Gothic arch, and he kind of fell in love with the Gothic. And also had the opportunity there to look at medieval illuminated manuscripts, which he loved. And in a sense, what he was trying to do was to produce, in his own age, something like a medieval illuminated manuscript. So a little bit that for background. Ostensibly, the Songs of Innocence, certainly, and theoretically the Songs of Innocence and Experience, were meant to be aimed at children. And they were, you know, they weren't completely unique production, in the sense that there was a tradition of home-printed little chapbooks of poetry, and there was even a tradition of poetry for children. The nearest precedent to the kind of poetry, beautiful, simple, rhythmic, calling on the traditions of nursery rhyme and ballad, but focusing them on the spiritual and the divine reality shining through. The nearest to that, probably, is Isaac Watts, the great hymnographer, who produced in 1715 a book called Divine Songs for Children. And Blake may well have been aware of that. Although what Blake does very subtly is to start off in the Innocence with the sometimes too comfortable, sometimes too easy, almost superficial, comfortable piety. And nicely landed endings, and everything's cheery and nice for children. That's in the Watts. Because, as we will see as we go through some of these, Blake was acutely aware of the horrific conditions under which many children in London, the children of the poor and the destitute, were living, and the number of literally street children that they were around. And it is, in a sense, even though the very small number of these books that were produced obviously went to people that could afford to buy them, in a sense, the children being addressed are not those of the households that bought the books. And that's part, of course, of the power of what he was doing. He was in the business, in every sense, politically, psychologically, cosmically. He was in the business of raising consciousness and awareness, and we'll see that as we move through this. So in the booklet I've given you, I've put the cover, you can go from the colour of the book, let's see, of the combined Songs of Innocence and Experience. And then this extraordinary movement, which is constantly going on in Blake's illumination, between organic growth and flame. There's a poem called The Blossom, where you get a blossom coming up, but the blossom is itself almost a flame. And there's a constant sense, as it were, of a fiery light shining through the, what he calls the vegetable. You know, he constantly contrasts the vegetable and organic eye, for example, and the divine eye that sees the true light. And he says, I don't consult my vegetable and organic eye. And ask it questions about what's there anymore than I would ask questions of a window. I see through it, not with it. And that sense of throughness, I think, is pretty much there all the time. So I'm going to take you through more or less in a kind of order. Obviously, I couldn't give you everyone, we haven't got time to do, so I just picked certain key poems. But I want you to have a sense of progression. I want you to feel, as you walk along, that to some degree, Blake is going to lull you into a false sense of pious security and complacency. And when he's got you in that slightly twilly pious zone, he's going to blow it wide open, because that's what he does. So on the first page that I've given you, I've also given you the frontispiece, which is for a poem. It's actually for a poem I haven't reproduced. But I just want you to see this image of a naked musician who's also a shepherd. He's a shepherd, you can see the sheep behind him. But he's not looking at the sheep and he hasn't got a crook. What he has is a pipe. He's a wild piper. And he's this idealized human figure, male, mature human figure, walking towards you, holding the pipe, but looking neither at the sheep, you know, nor at us, but up at a heavenly child. And the babe, the child, is speaking to him and inspiring him. So the muse, in a sense, for this whole exercise is the child, but in a sense, it's the divine child. And Blake's sense of everything that Jesus had said about the kingdom of heaven belonging to children, about the children having their angels, about the necessity to be like a child in order to enter the kingdom of heaven, all of that is vivid to Blake. And there are poems in here about how it is that adults conspire to destroy the child, both in themselves and outside themselves, and how that reflects on the eternal spiritual realities. So let's start with The Lamb, which is fairly early in the Songs of Innocence, and which some of you may know. There's a number of beautiful musical settings of this. I should also add that one thing that's a regrettable loss in literary history is that we don't have the genes. We do know that Blake sang these songs and made up tunes for them. And it would be lovely for me to have the tunes for some of these. But there's a great contemporary composer who wrote The Protecting Bear. What's his name?
Tavner.
Thank you, John Tavner. He's done, I don't know if you've heard Tavner's set of this. Mm. But let me read you The Lamb. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I, a child, and thou a lamb. We are called by his name, little lamb, God bless thee, little lamb, God bless thee. Oh, it's very sweet and lovely. The illustration is also quite sweet and fluffy. However, you picked up some of the biblical resonances straight away. He's got that sense. We begin with a simple pastoral scene and the child asking the lamb, if the child's almost giving the lamb a kind of catechism, do you know who made you? And then the child telling the lamb about Jesus. He is called by thy name, so we're thinking of John the Baptist saying, behold, the Lamb of God. Of course, Blake is fully aware, Blake's knowledge of the Bible is astonishing, and he's fully aware that the point about Jesus being the Lamb of God is not, it's not a comparison that says, oh look, lambs are sweet, woolly and fluffy, and Jesus is sweet, woolly and fluffy. Isn't that nice? That is not what John the Baptist was saying when he said, "Behold the Lamb of God, behold him who takes away the sins of the world." John the Baptist knew that he lived in a system in which lambs were sacrificed and in which the blood of the lamb was supposed to make the sinner clean. And in John's Gospel, of course, the whole timing, the way it's worked out in the timing of John's Gospel, which is slightly different from the synoptics, the crucifixion takes place at the point at which the lambs are being slaughtered for the Passover. And, of course, it is the blood of the lamb on the door of the lintel which makes the destroying angel pass over. So there's one sense in which he's touching on that bigger overarching thing, that sense of sacrifice, that sense of Christ as the lamb. But Christ also is the one who loves the child and knows the child and is going to honour the child. I, a child, and thou, a lamb. We are called by his name. Now, we can see why Christ was called by the name of the Lamb from that passage in John. What is happening when he says, "We are called by thy name"? Well, Blake is constantly echoing the Bible, and what he's doing there almost certainly is directly recalling the extraordinary and beautiful oracle in Isaiah 43, actually the whole 43 probably. But now, thus says the Lord, "He who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name, and you are mine. I have called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you, for I am the Lord your God." So that promise to be with, and to be with in the waters and the fires, and you'll see constantly water and fire running through this. And it's an incredibly powerful evocation, as we get to experience, of the appalling sufferings that we inflict on one another, and the particular epitome or sign of that suffering in the suffering of children. And that sense that there is a lamb identified with the child who is suffering along with and inside them is really key. But I think he's particularly thinking when he says, when the child says to the lamb, "We are called by thy name," he's thinking of verses 6 and 7. My eyesight is failing, it's terrible. "I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from far away, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made, called by my name, we are called by his name." So in this simple and beautiful evocation, we can begin to feel that he is also evoking and calling forth the powerful presence of the living God in and with and in the midst of those who are weak and those who may well be passing through fire and water. So, fairly shortly after that, we get a really quite extraordinary poem, particularly extraordinary for its time, which again, you might feel, starts in a slightly twee, we might almost fear, patronizing way, although it very, very rapidly changes in its tenor. And this is the little black boy. I wish I could show you the illustrations for each of these, but you can see some of them on here. The illustration for this has an absolutely beautiful picture of a shading tree. And there's an African woman who's amazingly well drawn. It's not at all a kind of, as you might have expected in Europe of that period, a kind of grossly exaggerated or caricaturish picture. It's very exact. But then one of the jobs that Blake had to do was to do the engravings for an account of the suppression of a Negro rebellion in the West Indies, I think. And he had read the book that he'd seen just the absolutely appalling things that had been done. And he seems somehow, whether through other engravings or whatever, to have got quite a clear, strong image. I'm just looking to find his theory. So that one of the illustrations that he does in this book of somebody else's account of this suppression, of this rebellion, is a picture of a gallows, and it's a Negro hung alive by his ribs. And there's this writhing figure, beautifully drawn, you know, extraordinarily dignified human figure with a kind of musculature that could have been done by Michelangelo, kind of almost bent from this gallows. And then there are skulls in various places, but there's a skull right beneath the gallows. And it's just a suggestion in the way that St. Blake is drawing of Christ on the cross. So there's a picture of an African woman, and there are two children playing, and there's a tree which is again turning into flame, and a sun, a powerful and extraordinary sun, rising behind them. And there are two children playing, one back, one way. So here's the poem. The little black boy. My mother bore me in the southern wild, and I'm black, but oh, my soul is white. White as an angel is the English child, but I am black as if bereaved of light. My mother taught me underneath a tree, and sitting down before the heat of day, she took me on her lap and kissed me, and pointing to the east, began to say, look on the rising sun. There God does live, and gives his light, and gives his heat away, and flowers and trees and beasts and men receive comfort in morning, joy in the noonday. And we are put on earth a little space, that we may learn to bear the beams of love. And these black bodies and this sunburnt face are but a cloud, and like a shady grove. For when our souls have learned the heat to bear, the cloud will vanish. We shall hear his voice saying, come out from the grove, my love and care, and round my golden tent, like lambs, rejoice. Thus did my mother say and kiss at me, and thus I say to little English boy, when I from black and he from white cloud free, and round the tent of God like lambs we joy, I'll shade him from the heat, till he can bear to lean in joy upon our father's knee. And then I'll stand and stroke his silver hair, and be like him, and he will then love me. Now, there's something really remarkable going on there, because it starts with, you know, I am black, but oh, my soul is white, which was almost a kind of cliche of the early missionary societies. It was the kind of, you know, honestly, deep down inside, their little English children, if only you could make them so, as it were, the kind of white soul, and, you know, but the presumption that the blackness and that everything that went with that and the culture was all somehow to be got, you know, just not important, there's nothing to come from it. And then we could somehow, you know, turn them all into little white children. And you might think, in fact, I think Blake wants you to think at that point, so you read on, if you're the protective parent who brought the book to read to their child, you might think it's going to kind of carry on in that vein. But actually it doesn't. What happens next is that the little black boy, without reference to anything that the USPG or anybody else might have sent over in the improving tract, actually talks about what he was taught by his mother from within his own culture. That's the first thing. And he talks about learning, as it were, to come into the presence of God and learning to bear love. Love, you know, I mean, love becomes that glorious, and, you know, our God is a consuming fire. It becomes that powerful, all-changing radiance and glory, which we must learn gradually to name and to bear. Look on the rising sun, where God does live. Then we are on the earth a little space, that we may learn to bear the beams of love. This is very simple, but astonishingly beautiful writing. And the idea that love is something we need to learn to bear, it's extraordinary, that we need to learn to accommodate ourselves to the real powers and depths of that love, which could be released within us, but which would be all transforming if we let it be there. That cosmic and divine love, which is a kind of light and a heat. And God is like the sun in that he gives everything away. I love that image. He gives his light and gives his heat away, just as the sun constantly radiates out to all. Of course, this is an image that Jesus uses when he talks about the sun shining on all, because the rain falls on all. And it'd be like your Father in heaven who sends his light, sends his rain on all. So the teaching at this point is actually coming not from the white boy to the black boy, but the other way around. And then, when our souls have learned the heat to bear, the cloud will vanish. Extraordinary. Now, that's very Bacon idea, that as it were, everything is slightly clouded for us now. We don't see things properly, but when we see things properly, we will see the radiance of God in each other, if we can learn to bear it, if we can learn to recognize it. And in a sense, we've actually been subtly prepared for this by the little lamb poem and the kind of kinship between the child and the lamb. But we've moved from meek and mild to something altogether more dynamic and energetic and powerful, of which the glorious rays of the sun are the analogy. When our souls have learned the heat to bear, the cloud will vanish, we shall hear his voice. Now what happens when that happens? He imagines, as it were, the black child and the white child coming together into the radiant presence of the Father. And the black child says to the white child, the African child says to the English child, I'll shade him from the heat till he can bear to lean in joy upon our Father's name. This is a mutual need, but in this case, this is the black child is actually going to help the white child to know what love truly is. And it's as it were going to shade. And in that sense, the black has now become a virtuous thing. The black body, the presumption on the part of, you know, the anthropologists and sociologists of the day is that it's hotter in the southern climes and that somehow the black skin enables you to bear the heat. Now, because the heat has become a symbol of the divine and cosmic love, the black, which was the issue at the beginning, has become, as it were, the gift and the virtue, the thing that's needed by the other child. And then I'll stand and stroke his silver hair, and then this extraordinary, almost kind of sting in the tail, and be like him, and he will then love me. The little black child knows from the beginning, from the outset of the poem, that the English child at this stage, whom he wants to love, will hate him for the colour of his skin. And actually there's going to be need to be a whole series of stages of spiritual progress for the English child in order, within the divine love, to learn how to love the one who is other, the one who is different. So it's a very simple and beautiful little poem, but it moves in an unexpected way. And when you think about when it was written, when you think about the whole, I mean, obviously we were still, fully engaged in the slave trade with the approbation of Parliament and, the House of Bishops. And, you know, Wilberforce still had a huge, long battle to go. It was being fought. And Blake, we know, was very much part of that campaign against the slave trade. But I don't think there's anybody else that writes quite like this, or writes this, you know, and as it were, gives this, what is effectively a gospel of liberation. And the lines there, I mean, it makes no overt, the other poems are much more overtly Christian, and I think the whole book is framed in a Christian way. And I'm going to talk next week specifically about Blake and Jesus. But I want to make it clear that Blake doesn't think that the glory of God in the rising sun, and I don't think there's any question that he intends a pun on sun, and that he's thinking about Christ and the resurrection. The glory of God is not, as it were, shut up and contained. Jesus is the Lamb of God. There's a fantastic things to be able to pass on. But the idea that the person already sitting under the tree with their mother hasn't got an idea of who God is or what grace is or what love is, that's nowhere in Blake's conception. Blake absolutely understands that. Now, where did he get that from? You know, when you think how narrow and how parochial, I mean, English views were at the time. Now, there are two answers to that question, and Blake could give you both of them. The this-worldly answer would be to say that among the first books he had to engrave was a key to all mythologies, as it were. It wasn't called that. I mean, but it's a similar idea. Somebody written a whole thing, trying to do as much research as they could on how the different mythological systems of the world might begin to point in the same direction, and Blake had engraved for that. So he was pretty well aware of the hints and glories and possibilities and possible connections in other religious systems. And it's clear from some of the illustrations to his later books that he was familiar with the symbols of a wide variety of religions, including including Hinduism and Buddhism. But Blake would say that he had visions, and Blake's other answer would be simply to say that he had been in the spirit to all these places and seen them from within, because from within you could see all these things. And in fact, in one of the poems which I haven't given you here, in the beginning of Songs of Experience, there's a voice of the bard, and the bard specifically says that he has access to all time and space. So, there's a Doctor Who of poetry. So, there's an interesting poem. We're still in the Songs of Innocence. But we can see, even in this Song of Innocence, there's a testing and a questioning of what's going on in his own culture. Another one from the Songs of Innocence, one of the most famous ones, which has justly become a hymn in the church as well, although more of these, in my view, could be hymns. You may well all know this one, the Divine Image. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress. And to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human grace. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is glory too. Now, I think, that is a profoundly orthodox Christian poem. That whole sense that all those values which are in God are in us because he's been made in his own image and have become human in the most profound way because God himself became a human being in Christ. And it's all, there could not be a more Blakean phrase than the human form divine. He loves to put the words human and divine together constantly. And of course, we all know in Jerusalem, which is the little lyric that he appended at the beginning of his book Milton, about which I'll say more next week, he thought of Christ as having the countenance divine when he wondered if the child of Christ had come with Joseph of Arimathea to wander through England. And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills, as Jerusalem built here on those dark satanic hills. And you remember I told you last week that, and I can tell you how old he was now, I've gone back and looked at it. The very first thing, you know, obviously when you're an apprentice, you just spend your time learning how to engrave and you copy exactly what you're given. But his kind master at some point thought, well, let's just give the boy a free exercise. He can do anything he likes. And said, you know, you can do what you like. You can use models from anywhere in the classical world, but you can make your own composition. And he did a picture called Joseph of Arimathea Among the Rocks of Albion. And it's actually based on a figure of Michelangelo's of a soldier, interestingly, which he completely changes for a soldier into a pilgrim with the herd and the staff. And he did this picture. So that sense of the child of Jesus coming. So, it's a powerful and beautiful thing. And it's not saying, he did write an early little pamphlet called All Religions Are One, but I'm not sure that that was his mature view in the sense that he finally felt that they're all saying the same thing, although he might want to say that they all have to deal ultimately with the same final reality, the same first reality, the same depths of the human soul, the same cries of distress. I think when Kipling later wrote that extraordinary little verse in Kim, in one of the chapter headings of Kim, you know that one, my brother kneels so set for beer to wood and stone and human wires, but in my brother's prayers I hear my own unanswered agonies. His gods are as his fates assign. His prayer is all the words of mine. I think Kipling's probably recollecting this poem, and certainly it's saying the same thing. Every man of every kind that prays in his distress prays to the human form, divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. Now, ultimately, within the gospel, we have a sense of exactly how to give a name to that human form divine. But the human form divine is nevertheless lying behind every religious struggle, every effort to call for the mercy that we all need. So, those were poems I just gave you straight from the Songs of Innocence. What I want to do now is to start looking at these extraordinary pairings. And had you, you know, just got one of the 25 copies of the Songs of Innocence of 1789, you wouldn't have known what was coming, as it were. You would have just read the first ones that I'm giving you. And then you would have had to wait, you know, 5 years for the next instalment. And suddenly, you'd not only have a new poem with the same title, but you would be obliged by that new poem to reread the first poem. And all kinds of things in the first poem that you hadn't quite seen would be there, and you would begin to perceive a fearful symmetry. So I want to read you, I think, yeah, we'll read them separately. We'll comment on them separately, but you'll see how the second one comes in. So I'm going to read you the two poems, both called The Chimney Sweeper, first from Innocence and then from Experience. He subtitled Songs of Innocence and Experience with the words, showing the two contrary states of the human self. He didn't say showing the progressive movement from one to the other. Identity was of the view that innocence is wiped out by experience. I think he felt that in all of us, once we have experience as well as innocence, innocence and experience are in a constant contrary dialogue with one another, out of which progress comes for us. I don't think he was ever suggesting that we should deny experience, but rather that we should recognize that they are both constantly, simultaneously, contrary and yet mutually symmetric states of ourselves. Does that make sense? Well, let's look at what he does with The Chimney Sweeper. Here's the first one. Notice how many of these poems, by the way, are voiced for the child. They're not, as it were, the grown-up looking down, as it were, and trying to give, you know, sort of improving sentiments to the child. Although that comes in sometimes. They're really voiced for the child. I mean, in a way, this is horrific poem. Sometimes, you know, when you know the experienced ones, the innocent ones are almost more horrific. Anyway, Chimney Sweeper. When my mother died, I was very young, and my father sold me, while yet my tongue could scarcely cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep. There's little Tom Dacre, who cried when his head that curled like a lamb's back was shaved. So I said, hush, Tom, never mind it, for when your head's bare, you know that the soot cannot spoil your white hair. And so he was quiet. And that very night, as Tom was asleep, he had such a sight that thousands of sweepers, Dick, Joe, Ned, and Jack, were all of them locked up in coffins of black. And by came an angel who had a bright key, and he opened the coffins and set them all free. Then down a green plain, leaping, laughing, they run, and wash in a river and shine in the sun. Then naked and white, all their bags left behind, they rise upon clouds and sport in the wind. And the angel told Tom if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father and never want joy. So Tom awoke, and we rose in the dark and got with our bags and our brushes to work. Though the morning was cold, Tom was happy and warm. So, if all do their duty, they need not fear harm. I'll read you the second one straight away, and then I will read you something about what Chimney Sweeper was like at the time that this poem was written. So here's the second Chimney Sweeper. A little black thing among the snow, crying, weep, weep, in notes of woe. Where are thy father and mother, say? They're both gone up to the church to pray. Because I was happy upon the heath and smiled among the winter's snow, they clothed me in the clothes of death and taught me to sing the notes of woe. And because I am happy and dance and sing, they think they have done me no injury and are gone to praise God and his priest and king who made up a heaven of our misery. Now, let me... I should have brought my reading glasses. This is how I'm going to go up the rest of the passage. There's a reference here in the dancing and singing to an extraordinary thing that used to happen each May Day in London. I just read you as Peter Ackroyd tells it. On the first day of May each year, a holiday was granted to the young chimney sweeps of London, known as climbing boys or lily whites. For the rest of the year, they were engaged in calling the streets from the dark hours before dawn until midday. But on this one festival, they were permitted to celebrate. Their faces were whitened with meal, their heads covered with high periwigs powdered as white snow, and their clothes bedaubed with paper lace. Southey saw a later version of this festival, quote, "Their clothes seemed as if they'd been dragged through the chimney, as indeed had been the case, and these sooty habiliments were bedecked with pieces of foil and with ribbons of all gay characters, flying like streamers in every direction. As they whirled around, their sooty faces were reddened with rose pink, and in the middle of each cheek was a patch of gold leaf. The hair was frizzed out and as white as powder could make it, and they wore an old cocked hat for the occasion, and in like manner, ornamented with ribbons and foil and flowers. They also banged their brushes and climbing tools as they paraded through the city. They were the lords of misrule, for that day had become white and clean and even beautiful." How the people laughed. And perhaps even the little boys themselves were for a while able to forget the conditions of their wretched existence. They were generally sold between the age of 4 and 7, apprenticed, i.e., but actually sold. A sum of money was handed over, and the child was never seen again. They were generally sold between the age of 4 and 7. They either left the poorhouse in batches or were individually bartered by their parents, who would accept between 20 and 30 shillings for their 7-year apprenticeship. There was a great need for their services in London, where the flues were characteristically narrow or twisted so that they easily became constricted. The average size of these vents was something like 7 inches square, and the small child was prodded or pushed into the even smaller spaces within. Sometimes they were encouraged with poles or pricked with pins or scorched with fire to make them climb with more enthusiasm. Of course, many died of suffocation, while others grew deformed. Many others suffered from what were known as sooty warts or cancer of the scrotum. One social reformer described a typical climbing boy towards the end of his career. "He is now 12 years of age, a cripple on crutches, hardly 3 foot 7 inches in stature. His hair felt like a hog's bristles, and his head like a warm cinder. He repeats the Lord's Prayer." That's what was going on. In fact, when these boys had done the early morning sweeping, they were just turned out onto the streets to beg. When the printed out version, which I got off the web and printed out for you, I realized has a characteristic error. In the actual inscribed version, every time you get the word weep, kind of weep, weep, which you see in both poems, Blake puts an apostrophe before it, for the missing S. Sweep, sweep. Sweep, sweep is what they're meant to be calling out. And he just sees the weep, as it were, in sweep, and gives it there. So now you can see something extraordinary going on, because this appalling system is then being, as it were, kind of literally pasted and powdered over, literally forcing them, putting the rose and on the cheeks and the wig and these kids being herded, and they're kind of paraded through as a sort of display. So we can all feel okay about it now, because look at the sweep of the chimney sweeps. And the sense of horror in Blake is as much as anything to do with not the horror of what is going on, but the way in which all the adults, as it were, are complicit in kind of dressing it up and trying to make it seem okay. And that is also, of course, what lies behind the next pair of poems I'm going to look up for you, which is Holy Thursday, where I have to say it's not just wider society, but specifically the church, which is really severely and widely indicted. Now, there were other people protesting about this, and in fact, this poem was published in by Blake, if you can call it publishing, making these individual copies and painting them and selling them what you could. But in 1789, in 1788, there'd been an MP actually did try to get a full petition to Parliament, setting out just those kind of details that you've heard. It was completely rejected by the Houses of Parliament. They made no change in the law whatsoever, notwithstanding having had the full facts set before them. And so the establishment in terms of the MPs and the establishment in terms of the Lords and of course the bishops in the House of Lords were all okay with this and were even citing the Merry Boys on their May Day parade as a sign that everything was really okay, which of course is exactly what Blake picks up in that because I am happy and dance and sing, they think they've done me no injury and are gone to praise God and his priest and king, who made up a heaven of our misery. And just extraordinary. Now, made up a heaven is an extraordinary, there's all kinds of things going on linguistically there, in terms of, is this an attack, it's all just completely made up? Or is it related to a poem that he puts near the beginning of the Songs of Experience, which we also look at shortly, The Clod and the Pebble, which is a profound spiritual insight into what is the difference between heaven and hell. But this poem, In the Innocent, comes after the divine image, after the Lamb, after all those things which talk about God within us, and those allusions to Isaiah about when you go through fire and when you go through water, I will be with you. And in that first one, The Innocent poem, this extraordinary thing of the kids who have been put into coffins and then set up, we lost them, we did die young. But there's also that sense of the sheer constriction, these horrible dark holes that they're being kind of pushed into. And then the angel who comes, the angel with the bright key, the sense of the joy and the glory that they should have, the deliberate, all the imagery from the book of Revelation there, the river and the sun, the river of life, the river of light. Of course, there's the sense that the angels, these children have their angels. And as it were, what is to become of the angels and the children, and how are the adults ultimately to be called to account for that is something that Blake thinks about a lot. So he ends the Innocent poem with this kind of wise admonition, do your duty and you'll fear no harm, And it's extraordinary that this child, in the report that I just read from, it was all right because he could recite the Lord's Prayer. Somebody felt that they'd done their Christian duty by this child, by simply teaching them to recite this formula and not reflecting on anything that might be involved in the words, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So, of course, the angel and the vision of heaven and the church, is there in an extraordinary juxtaposition and judgment on the chimney sweep. Well, let's go on. As a contrast, another pair that's kind of similar in a way. Gosh, time is going by, I'm not going to do this. To Holy Thursday. You're thinking, Holy Thursday? I don't remember Holy Thursday. I know about Good Friday. What's Holy Thursday? Holy Thursday was originally the term for Ascension Day. It's quite important to know. Ascension Day falls on Thursday. And there was another of these extraordinary sort of ritual pageants involving rounding up the children of the poor and the destitute, or children who were simply street children and destitute children. Now, this is a slightly more kind of subtle one. This was an occasion which happened annually on or near Ascension Day in St. Paul's Cathedral. And it actually involved numbers of up to 6,000 children. And these were the children of the so-called charity schools, which were obviously charity schools. They were originally there to kind of help and mentor these kids. But what had actually happened was, of course, they then became simply the sources of supply for all the people who had use for children. And some of those uses were terrible. you know, they were being apprenticed out and then come up and charge a school at, you know, at the end of the day. And essentially, you know, these were just kind of bachelor children kept in tapping places, you know, simply there to be exploited by adults in different ways. But then they were all herded into church once a year in a very, very public space. And they were all given, you know, they were kind of costumes and everything, you know, they were all kind of cleaned and dressed and made to do this thing. And they built special wooden rafters, because you're getting 6,000 kids into St. Paul's. They put like temporary scaffolding up with a kind of gallery all the way around, of course, the Beatles, and they keep an eye on them. And then they, all the patrons of the charity schools and the kind of, you know, people in the city and the guilds, all in their finery sat, you know, in their normal pews in St. Paul's, these kind of kids kind of roosted above them for this service. And they were all processed in two by two. So here are Blake's on either side of the copper plate, contrasting accounts of this day. But Ascension Day is important. Bear in mind the sense of the connection between heaven and earth. What happens, of course, in Ascension Day is that Christ, having risen, having the Lamb, having been slain, having become, you know, has gone down into the very depth and the pit and the black coffin and all of those things, taking human nature, found us in that dark place, brought us up in resurrection, and is now taking the whole of humanity and human nature into heaven, into the core of heaven. And there's a sense in the first one where there's almost a kind of glimpse of heaven, and yet, ironically, of course, it's a facade. Let's hear the two poems in sequence. 'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Grey-headed beadles walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like Thames water flow. Oh, what a multitude they seemed, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies they sit with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs, thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now like a mighty wind they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like harmonious thunderings the seats of heaven among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door. An extraordinary end to it. Let's read the poem from the Songs of Experience. Is this a holy thing to see in a rich and fruitful land? Babes reduced to misery, fed with cold and usurious hand. Is that trembling cry a song? And can it be a song of joy? And so many children poor. It is a land of poverty, and their sun does never shine, and their fields are bleak and bare, and their ways are filled with thorns. It is eternal winter there. For where'er the sun does shine, and where'er the rain does fall, babe can never hunger there, nor poverty the mind appall. Extraordinary turn from it. In the songs of joy, we can that's a terrible thing, that line is that trembling kind of song. And you can remember, you can think of all these children, you know, they're doing it, they've got no choice, but also for them at least it's one day when they're not up these dreadful chimneys or doing other terrible things. It's obviously better to be sat, dressed and washed and clean and St. Paul's and the other things they might be doing. But, you know, the sheer kind of pain and misery, alienation of these children, you know, they're all now supposed to sing jolly little songs. And the first Holy Thursday here, this is what they'd like it to seem like. You know, these flowers of London town, the little boys and girls raising their innocent hands, you know, having the voice of song, harmonious. That's, as it were, the appearance that everybody wanted to make, and the church and everybody else was complicit in this, literally, a whitewash. It's literally putting whitewash on it. Engrimed with sooty faces of children who would never otherwise be there at all. But when you read the Innocence poem again, having read the Experience one, and having, as it were, begun to pick up the constant references in this to the prophets and to the Book of Revelation, and you think of who are these, this multitude, look at the words multitudes, multitudes sounds like a river, a mighty wind, harmonious thunderings. If you go to the first vision in the book of Revelation of those who worship in heaven, who are they, these clothed in white? These are they who have washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb. And the worship of heaven is like the multitude and the thundering of many waters. And there's a sense in which I think he's saying, although we've done this fake, horrible, whitewashing thing of what it's supposed to be, actually, these children's angels and the ones who died, the children themselves, are standing before the Lamb upon the throne. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. These children, as it were, are utterly saved. They are the radiant angels, and the shine of the radiance all their own is not the false radiance that sort of adult exploitative sentimentality has painted over them, but the actual true radiance of them in their glory. And so the physical fact of beneath them sit the aged men, white, doubled and poor, which is a physical fact of the arrangement, St. Paul's, is also profoundly a spiritual fact. And that's what Baker's always doing. He's seeing, he is an apocalyptic writer. He, in a sense, it's a revelation, apocalypse. It's taking away the veil, showing you the things it really is. And of course, the wise guardians of the poor are actually those who feed them with a cold and usurious hand. But they are below these children. They are below these children spiritually. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, Blake is saying, if they don't reconnect the child themselves and completely reforce, they're going to be below these children in hell, as it were. You know, they're not going to get out of the hell that they are in, which made them do this to children. The children themselves are already, in a sense, in heaven. Now, to make that a little bit clearer, I've given you immediately after it, and we may have to draw stumps, actually, after this one, despite of the other lovely ones I wanted to do with you, you have to read it for yourself, with the card and the pebble, which seems to me, since we've got so many contraries, we have progression through contraries, the two sides of it. This is a poem in which, if you like, the innocence and experience, the ecstatic spiritual vision, which is attainable by anybody at any point because the child and the angel are with them at all times and they'll let them be there, or the cold and usurious hand and the kind of exploitativeness and the hellishness in us, are also, these are the contrary states of the human self. And this is just, I think this is as a piece of spiritual insight, which was written in a particular time and place, but is just true for all people in all times and all places. I think this is unsurpassed. The clod and the pebble. Love seeketh not itself to please, nor for itself hath any care, but for another gives its ease, and builds a heaven in hell's despair. So sung a little clod of clay, trodden with the cattle's feet, but a paddle of the brook, or will not these meters meet? Love seeketh only self to please. To I think that basically sums it all. And I think that built a hell in heaven's despair is right at the core of Blake's spiritual vision. Blake is only too aware of the hells that we build for one another, and has a keen analysis of how does we do that, why we do that, why religion has become a perverted part of that. And in the prophetic books that we'll look at in the final session, we'll show how through two figures, Hawk and Lot, he talks about how religion can be redeemed, as it were, how we can get out of these cold hells that we go through another, how we can renew our spiritual vision, and how we need a full engagement with the imagination and with the childlike in us to do that. But it is possible to do that, and that's what Blake's writing is all about. But although he's conscious of the hell we build, he says, we are building a hell in heaven's despite. Actually, heaven is the prime reality. Actually, in some sense for Blake, it's the only reality, and we're all already there. But we have chosen, in the midst of all the heavenly possibilities, not, as it were, to receive the rays of love, which we cannot bear yet. But we've chosen instead to project things upon one another and construct our own things and build these tiny, little, frail, actually agonized, perilous and illusory castles of the grasping ego, which we then defend and even use the very religion that was said to liberate us, we use as a weapon to defend our own places and privileges. And these two possibilities, the possibilities of building a heaven in hell's despair at any moment, or of constructing our own little hell in spite of heaven, These two possibilities are constantly present to every soul at every minute. That is the choice that everybody makes at all times. And the point about printing these two things together was to actually say, not, oh, those are the bad people over there, you know, who did those bad things, but I'm with the innocent. No, you're not with the innocent, actually. You have both sides of the copper plate in the early moment, but you also have a reality of choice. And these are fairly early works of Blake. And what I want to show in the next two sessions is how he shows us the various ways, particularly through engagement with the arts of imagination, that we can stop building a hell in heaven's despise and begin to build a heaven even in hell's despair. So we're going to stop there. I'm afraid I have to fly, because I've got to be at 7. Do keep the